1981 began with the specter of violence that would become perhaps the major story of the year.
The assassination of musician John Lennon in the final days of 1980 set the stage for act after dizzying act of violence.
If you ever go down to Atlanta town, it's a pity and it's a shame.
A series of killings which began in 1979 continued into 1981. In all, 28 young blacks were murdered in and around the city of Atlanta.
The long and often frustrating investigation became a costly burden for police, prompting offers of help from and guaranteed publicity for a crowd ranging from psychics to singers such as Sammy Davis Jr.
So Atlanta goes, so shall we all. We cannot let what happens here go unheeded and unanswered. And if I sound like sometimes a little bigger than life, it's because maybe that's what the man upstairs put me here for, to bring attention to something.
Under mounting pressure, the White House offered federal help. A 23-year-old black suspect arrested in June was charged with two of the Atlanta killings.
Coretta Scott King, herself no stranger to the loss of a loved one at the hand of violence, summed up the pain and frustration an entire nation had felt.
Something is fundamentally wrong with a society which creates such sickness and depravity. The entire tragic episode leaves us with an alarming but clear conclusion. No one is safe and secure, and everyone is affected by the current epidemic of violence.
Indeed, even one of the nation's most protected citizens would not escape the year's violent trend.
I felt very comfortable with the intelligence that we had that day.
Secret Service agent Jerry Parr, in charge of presidential security on Monday, March 30th, as Ronald Reagan made a routine appearance at the Washington Hilton Hotel.
We asked for a situation report 30 seconds before we got there. I would have known if there had been a problem, and there was none. It was a very quiet arrival, and basically, it was a quiet departure until the gunfire.
About six shots. It sounded like someone emptied a revolver right in my ear. And I could see instantly that there was a terrible melee. It took me about 1 second to figure out exactly what had happened, that indeed there was an assassination attempt.
Associated Press radio correspondent Walter Rogers was waiting outside the hotel, reporters call it a stakeout, hoping to ask the president a question. As Rogers turned his microphone toward the president, the man next to Rogers was taking aim with a gun.
Absolute confusion ensued as the shots rang out. I was unable to see whether President Reagan was hit. Someone appeared to have been shot in the head. I saw them lying on the sidewalk, blood coming out of their head. It appeared as though Secret Service agents pushed the president into the back of the limousine, shielding him with their bodies. Again, I don't know whether the president was hurt.
I landed on top of the transmission riser that's in between the two seats, and he indicated that his chest was hurt. I told the driver to leave rapidly.
The presidential limousine was racing through Washington traffic, the chief executive security man still unaware the president had been hit.
I ran my hands over his body, under his arms, on his back, looking for some kind of a wound. Shortly after that, I would say in a space of 10 to 15 seconds, he complained of problem in breathing. He was getting a bit ashen in color. And then he started coughing up a little blood. It was bright red, and I knew from my training that this was oxygenated blood. This is the blood coming out of the lung. I told the driver immediately to head for George Washington, which we did.
For almost 45 anxious minutes, America and the world waited for word on the president's fate. Then, shocking news from presidential aide Lynn Nofziger.
I can confirm that the president has been shot once in the left chest. He is in stable condition, he is conscious, and Mrs. Reagan is with him.
Single bullet wound that entered slightly underneath the left armpit. It traversed about 3 inches of the chest wall and then ricocheted off the seventh rib into the left lower lobe of the lung and moved about 3 inches into the lung substance itself.
There was an upbeat prognosis from George Washington University Hospital spokesman Dr. Dennis O'Leary, who related how Reagan had joked with his wife Nancy, "Honey, I forgot to duck."
Only later was it reported the chief executive lost nearly half his total blood supply and might well have died had he not received medical attention when he did.
Back at the White House, Secretary of State Haig sought to reassure the nation in a not-so-reassuring voice.
"As of now, I am in control here in the White House, pending return of the vice president, and in close touch with him. If something came up, I would check with him, of course. We have informed our friends abroad of the situation. The president's condition, as we know it, stable, now undergoing surgery. And there are absolutely no alert measures that are necessary at this time or contemplated."
The suspect was soon identified as 25-year-old John Hinckley Jr., and there were reports his alleged action was an attempt to win the attention of movie actress Jodie Foster. In Colorado, the suspect's family issued a statement through an attorney.
"We are grieved and heartbroken by this tragedy. John has been under recent psychiatric care. These evaluations did not alert anyone to the seriousness of his condition. We love our son John and will, of course, stand by him. Our hearts and prayers go out to the victims and their loved ones."
Within weeks of the shooting, the president and the two officers wounded with him had left the hospital. White House News Secretary James Brady remained hospitalized for most of the year on a long and sometimes rough road to recovery. But doctors said, considering the extent of his head wound, even his survival had been miraculous.
Soon, President Reagan was on Capitol Hill defending American society.
"Six societies don't produce young men like Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, who placed his body between mine and the man with the gun simply because he felt that's what his duty called for him to do. Six societies don't produce dedicated police officers like Tom Delahanty, or able and devoted public servants like Jim Brady."
The president did not emerge from his ordeal with a change of heart on his opposition to gun control, nor did he heed suggestions he should isolate himself from the outside world. Senators Paul Laxalt and Robert Byrd viewed what happened as a sad fact of political life.
"This president doesn't want to be isolated as a prisoner in this White House. He wants to continue communicating with people. So what we have out here really, I think, to some measure is a price of freedom.
In this society that we have, which is an open society, it's, I hate to say that it's inevitable. I don't like to think that it's inevitable. But there's no way to guarantee that there won't be some occurrence again at some point in time."
May 13th, an ambulance races through the streets of Rome. Another world leader lies wounded.
"They seen the Pope coming up along the rail, shaking everybody's hand. And then from the crowd, we seen the smoke and the fire from the gun.
Suddenly somebody said, 'It's the Pope. He's shot.' Then they announced that the Pope's condition was grave, and everybody was very upset. And we kept praying, and we just kept praying, and there were songs sung in Polish by some choir, and people coming out crying and weeping, and it was really something."
Pope John Paul II was shot as he greeted a crowd in St. Peter's Square. As in the assassination attempt in Washington 6 weeks before, the intended victim's life was again spared.
"Alle due persone ferite insieme con me."
Within 5 days of the shooting, the pontiff was able to record a message in his hospital room, and the sound of his voice came as a relief for thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square.
In the weeks that followed the shooting, a prominent Roman Catholic American suggested one way to curb the violent trend. Senator Edward Kennedy, his own family twice the target of assassins' bullets, said the time for gun control was long overdue.
"It has been less than 2 weeks since the Pope was shot down, since the hand that was about to be raised in blessing was suddenly raised in pain. It has been less than 2 weeks since we felt the shots that went to the soul of the world. And when the Pope and our president have been wounded, it is long past time for us to say, 'Enough.'"
A world already hypnotized by slow-motion instant replays of attempted assassinations was in for yet another shock. It occurred on October 6th at a military parade near Cairo. that a man known as a peacemaker in his later years would die in a hail of shrapnel and gunfire.
The loss of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat was mourned by both friend, former President Jimmy Carter, and one-time foe, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Begin called Sadat's killers enemies of peace. President Reagan warned they may have killed a man, but not his ideas.
In life, you feared Anwar Sadat, but in death you must fear him more, for the memory of this good and brave man will vanquish you.
In a scene unprecedented in modern U.S. history, three former presidents traveled to Cairo to pay America's last respects and march in a solemn funeral procession. The world had lost one of its most prominent leaders and nearly lost two others.
Not since the 1960s had there been such a resurgence of violence directed at political leaders. And the words of two who had felt the pain of the 60s seemed to haunt the beginning of another decade.
No one is safe and secure, and everyone is affected.
It is long past time for us to say enough.
The assassination of Anwar Sadat highlighted the continued instability throughout the Middle East.
And the United States was often its center stage, a key player in the Middle East drama.
In August, two Libyan planes were shot down after they fired on a pair of U.S. jets off the Libyan coast.
It was a strong reminder of the Reagan administration's high-profile policy in the region. The president spoke of the importance of Middle East oil to the entire Western world.
There's no way that we could stand by and see that taken over by anyone that would shut off that oil.
It was that argument the president emphasized in pushing for the sale to Saudi Arabia of some sophisticated radar planes called AWACS. Lawmakers threatened to veto the deal, Senator Henry Jackson expressing concern over the region's instability and recalling the revolution in Iran.
We lost the Phoenix missile as a result of a similar program in which we made available military equipment to the Shah. And that vital air-to-air missile system, we have to assume, is now in the hands of the Soviets.
The president, on the other hand, insisted the U.S. would never again abandon its allies.
In Iran, I think the United States has to take some responsibility for what happened there. With some very short-sighted policies and let a situation come to a boiling point, that there was no need to do that. I have to say that Saudi Arabia, we will not permit to be an Iran.
In the end, Reagan's arguments won out. The AWACS sale went through.
Israeli Prime Minister Begin called the U.S.-Saudi deal a serious threat to his nation's security. It was another in a series of sharp differences between Israel and the Reagan administration.
In June, Israeli warplanes carried out a devastating surprise attack on a nuclear reactor nearing completion in Iraq. The U.S. condemned the raid and temporarily blocked shipment of some U.S. fighter jets to Israel. Begin insisted the raid was a supreme act of self-defense.
Should the Iraqis try again to build a reactor through which they can produce atomic weapons, Israel will use all the possibilities at its disposal to destroy that reactor.
Among the nations condemning the Israeli raid was Iran, the same country fighting against Iraq in a war that had been dragging on for more than a year.
Internal strife caused the most trouble for Iran's shaky revolutionary regime. Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, ousted as president and threatened with execution, fled for France.
Back in Tehran, mass executions continued, street fighting flared, and an anti-government terrorist campaign was underway. 72 political leaders died in a bomb blast in June, and 2 months later, an explosion killed Iran's newly elected president and prime minister. Thousands marched in the streets.
The instability throughout the Persian Gulf and Middle East provided a strategic opening which the Soviet Union used to its advantage. The Soviet shadow over the region was highlighted by the continued occupation of Afghanistan by some 85,000 Russian troops. After invading that country in late 1979, the Soviets had managed to control only the principal cities, while bands of Muslim rebels rule the countryside, ambushing Soviet convoys almost at will. As the Soviet Union remained bogged down in Afghanistan, a new problem was developing in the communist bloc.
The independent labor movement Solidarity gained momentum, and Radio Moscow reflected Soviet concern.
It has been pointed out that tolerating further any manifestations of anti-Sovietism will do great damage to Soviet-Polish relations, but it contradicts Poland's allied commitments and the vital interests of the Polish people themselves.
In America, meantime, labor troubles of another sort.
I'll stay home. And that's what a lot of people should boycott the park, because these baseball players are making such big money.
In June, baseball team owners and players reached the breaking point in their contract dispute over free agent compensation. And in the world of baseball, the word strike took on a new meaning.
Well, I don't blame a fan personally for being disgusted with it. Well, you know, we get disgusted with it.
White Sox manager Tony La Russa's concern was echoed by Yankees outfielder Lou Piniella.
My feeling is one of amazement, confusion, that in 2 years of negotiating, this problem couldn't have been resolved by now.
With the Reagan administration pitching in, the strike finally ended after 49 days, and the cry, "Play ball," was heard across the lane.
In late October, the Los Angeles Dodgers came from behind to beat the New York Yankees in six games and win the 1981 World Series. On August 3rd, air traffic controllers went on strike against the Federal Aviation Administration. Union President Robert Poli said the issues were important enough for the government employees to break their no-strike oath.
The moment your blood pressure goes up, the moment you develop a nervous condition, the moment that you have an ulcer, you're finished as an air traffic controller. The only thing we're asking for is to be compensated for what's extracted from us during that period.
Eastern 233 is clear to land 9 left on 09015.
In the control towers, supervisory personnel were joined by military flight controllers, while airlines were ordered to cut flight schedules.
Eastern 12, contact departure.
Despite delays, the government declared the system safe, and after a two-day grace period, the president declared the 10,000 controllers still on strike fired.
I have no choice. The law is very explicit. They understood the law. They took an oath in writing that they would not strike. I think it's not a case of firing. I think they've quit.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
It was apparent Ronald Reagan, once a union leader, had a tenuous relationship with organized labor. In September, hundreds of thousands of union members rallied in Washington to condemn Reagan's policies. And in November, the AFL-CIO broke with tradition and failed to invite the president to its annual convention.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union.
Sing it with us.
I'm sticking to the union.
I'm sticking to the union.
Union. Oh, no, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
Thank you.
Residents of Northern Ireland have taken to calling them simply the Troubles. And in 1981, there were growing troubles in Ulster.
At the Mays Prison in Belfast, a group of Irish nationalists went on a protest fast, demanding they be treated as political prisoners and not common criminals. But even when hunger striker Bobby Sands died in May, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher stood her ground in Parliament.
Mr. Sands was a convicted criminal. He chose to take his own life. Yeah. It was a choice his organization did not allow to many of their victims. Yeah.
By October, 10 prisoners had starved themselves to death, and the Irish Republican Army, conceding at least partial victory to the British government, called an end to the hunger strike.
There were other problems for the United Kingdom. In a summer of high unemployment, riots broke out in several British cities, including London.
But in the middle of summer, there was a royal diversion. With an estimated 1 million people gathered in London and hundreds of millions of others tuned in on radio and television, the 32-year-old Prince of Wales and heir to the British throne married 20-year-old Lady Diana Spencer at St. Paul's Cathedral, in a ceremony full of pomp and pageantry.
I, Charles Philip Arthur George, take thee, Diana Francis.
I, Diana Francis, take thee, Philip Charles Arthur George.
To my wedded wife.
To my wedded husband.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
Better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
Better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
To love and to cherish.
For death as to part.
For as much as Charles Philip Arthur George and Diana Francis have consented together in holy wedlock, and have witnessed the same before God and this company, I pronounce that they be man and wife together, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost.
This is my last broadcast as the anchorman of the CBS Evening News. For me, it's a moment for which I long have planned, but which nevertheless comes with some sadness. For almost two decades, after all, we've been meeting like this in the evenings, and I'll miss that. Those who have made anything of this departure, I'm afraid, have made too much. This is but a transition, a passing of the baton.
That's the way it was in 1981. It was a year of transition for Walter Cronkite from anchorman to roving reporter.
For the hostages in Iran, from captivity to freedom.
For Ronald Reagan, from private citizen to world leader. And for Jimmy Carter, from world leader to private citizen.
For the American people, from great society to supply side.
For women, from an uphill fight for the ERA to a first-time appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court.
For air traffic controllers, from the picket line to the unemployment rolls.
And for Prince Charles, from bachelorhood to family life.
1981, a year of transition.